So I want to start out with you, David. You decided to take a year off rugby. How did that work out for you?
Yeah, it was something I'd been thinking about. I started playing professionally as a 17-year-old, went straight from school to Perth, so sort of been at it for a while now. And after the last World Cup, was kind of looking at options and really wanted to get to the next World Cup. But it certainly takes a physical toll on the body and didn't feel like I could get through another 3 years of full-time rugby. So decided that a year off, 6 months kind of totally away from the game, and then 6 months in Japan would be a interesting thing to do. Certainly a risk, and I was a bit nervous about it. I copped a bit of flack about it, taking a year away, but it was something that I wanted to do.
Is it unusual? Do other elite athletes do similar things, or not very often?
There've been a few. New Zealand have done it with a number of their players. I guess in Australia, maybe not that common. Yeah, we've got a smaller playing pool, so I think we probably notice it more when players leave here.
And do you feel like it was the right decision now, looking in hindsight?
Yeah, it was an amazing year. I certainly learnt a lot. It wasn't what I expected. The 6 months away, we were working on a farm in Zimbabwe. Sort of bought my grandfather's farm from him, and the plan was to go over there, work for 6 months with a farm manager, and essentially hand it over. We had hopes of it becoming a bit of a hub for community development and working towards some sort of new model of farming and land ownership in Zimbabwe. But it was a massive reality check. Like, the week before we arrived, the government sent a letter saying that they were taking 60% of the farm. So some investment I'd lined up fell through, and it ended up just being a bit of Groundhog Day and a real dose of what life is like for so many millions and millions of people, where it's not easy. So I think at the time it wasn't enjoyable. It wasn't put your feet up and enjoy some time off. But one of those things where you look back, you think, I learnt a lot there. That's certainly given me something.
And Emma, what was your experience like there? You've obviously got a background in community development. Was it what you thought it was going to be?
Yes and no. I've been to Zimbabwe every year since I met Dave in 2009. So I've spent quite a bit of time there and time in rural areas and on the farm. But it's one thing to kind of swoop in for a week, and another thing to kind of be living for 6 months and to have, when we started at the farm, there were sort of between 40 and 50 staff that we were employing. And because we'd received that letter saying that they were taking 60% of the farm, that was obviously 60% of our livelihood. So within the first week of being there, Dave had to tell half the staff that there wouldn't be a job for them in the next month. And when to get anywhere, to go to town for supplies, have to drive through rural areas and see how people are living, and you know that you've just sent 20 staff back to living in those kind of rural subsistence conditions. Where in Zimbabwe, they don't even talk about unemployment. They talk about the informal sector, which is 90% of the country. It was a pretty grim... I guess reality check, like Dave said, and certainly made me think a lot about the structural change that needs to happen in order for people like the people that we were living alongside to have hope for a different kind of future.
And David, can you tell us a little bit about the organisation that you set up and what its goals were?
Sure. I helped set up an organisation. We were, I guess, very much doing the standard aid and development thing. You know, it started off with disaster relief. There was a cholera outbreak. There was a lot of HIV and AIDS in the community, a lot of child-headed households. So very much starting from that point and slowly introducing food and food and water security programs, working with local schools, getting a doctor into the area for the first time in 4 or 5 years. And then the stuff that sort of I found more exciting was moving towards a value chain approach to livestock. So actually helping rural farmers access markets that they usually get excluded from. And started that in 2008, and then in 2016, we handed it over to a big NGO. Fundraising, as I'm sure you know, can be fairly tiring.
Yeah, and never ending.
Yeah, we were working with a big NGO, and they really liked the project. And in the end, you know, they're going to be able to scale it up a lot more. So we kind of stepped back and learned a lot, met some amazing people. And I think it's one of those things you want to go and contribute and help out. But in many ways, I feel like I got more out of it, you know. I learned more. And it was certainly an enriching experience.
I did want to pick up on not only the food security stuff, but I guess the conservation aspect of that organisation, and a little bit about some of the other, I guess, campaigning side of things that you've done here in Australia. And you got arrested at Maules Creek for locking on to a big digger there as part of some wider protests around the lead forest. And non-violent direct action, it's a fairly big thing for people to do. It's not something, you know, a lot of people would attend a protest, but that's kind of the next level up. And I just wondered if you could talk me through the kind of decisions and discussions you made around that. You've obviously got quite a public platform, but that's, as I said, a really big decision for people to make. Was it a straightforward decision in the end? How did you come to do that?
I don't think anything's straightforward. It was definitely a process. I guess I grew up on a farm, and I don't really love nature and wildlife, and it's been a big part of my life. And if you look at the current state of things ecologically, it's not looking good.
Pretty grim.
And if you look at our current politics and the prospect of meaningful action, it's not looking good. And, you know, I think if you look through history, we're not the first society or group of people or generation to be facing these sorts of problems where you have big issues, in this case, I guess, climate change, and then as a part of that, coal mining in farming areas and water tables and all those sorts of things, and a lack of action from the government. And in a democracy like Australia, what are your options? And there's obviously all the petitions, protests, all that kind of thing, and had been part of them for a number of years, putting my name to campaigns to back the ill-fated carbon tax and all those sorts of things. And I guess it got to the point where I had friends who were quite involved up at Laird State Forest, at the blockade up there. And Canberra were having a thing where they were sending a whole bunch of Canberrans were going up for the weekend to show some support. And I decided I wanted to go up. And I guess even for someone who's been involved in loosely in and out of that sort of scene for a while, you still have maybe it's growing up on a farm, but I still kind of thought up there, we're going to go up there and it's going to be a bunch of hippies at this blockade, and they'll be interesting people, and I guess we got up there and it's everyday Australians who care.
Yep.
Everyday Australians who are willing to do more than just sign a petition and I guess have the means to be able to do that.
We've certainly seen stuff like that before at the Franklin, for example, but is it scary, like, getting arrested? Like, what was that like?
Yeah, it's a long process, especially out in the country. By the time we actually, like, decided, I was chained with this farmer, Rick, and by the time we'd kind of decided, yeah, righto, we've stopped work for the day, we're done, he was like, yeah, mate, yeah, we've called the truck, so you'll probably be here in about 2 hours. And I'm like, oh, dear. It's going to be a long time. We eventually got out of the station at about midnight. But I think the point I was trying to make earlier is I guess we love reading up about people struggle against apartheid, against slavery, against all these sorts of things where non-violent direct action and civil disobedience played such a big part, and in many cases was kind of the tipping point. And I don't know, I think it's getting to the point with action on climate change that, you know, that may be the next step for mass civil disobedience. You know, we've obviously seen there's so many people doing amazing work, and that was one of the things that was really uncomfortable about the lead state forest thing. Was I think I was the 300th and something person to get arrested, but there was obviously a bit more media because of the whole rugby thing and all the rest. And yeah, the mine went ahead. You know, Rick's kids now go to a school that's 4 km from the coal mine, and there's hundreds of tons of coal dust and whatever else.
Yeah.
But hopefully we can learn from that. You know, we just got to look further north to Adani and what's happening up there. There's plenty to be working for. You know, I think we all want a future that's better and has a livable planet and more, you know, more nature than there is at the moment.
Absolutely. We've done a lot of work, obviously, at the Australia Institute about our plans to essentially double our coal exports in the next 10 years. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of opportunities in the future, that's for sure, to protest. But that does bring into, I guess, you've obviously got very public-facing elements of your relationship and things like this, you know, that you engage in from time to time. Is that difficult to negotiate, Emma? How do you approach these types of things when you decide to get involved?
Yeah, it is hard, partly because if you're prepared to speak out about something, you end up with a lot of requests to speak out about everything. And it can be challenging to work out where to put your energy. I mean, Dave's got a full-time job, and so, you know, while these things are important, he kind of has a platform by virtue of that job. So we spend a lot of time thinking about where to put our energy. But with something like what happened up in Maules Creek, I guess we'd both got to a point where we'd kind of been involved in campaigns and realised that that there's an important part of being physically present. And I think, I guess, I recognise a lot of faces here tonight from various protests in Canberra over the last few years. And there is something really powerful about being with other people who care about the same things that you do. And it can be a grim and at times lonely road to tread when you're working toward a better future. And so while, you know, getting arrested is challenging and that there was certainly a lot of fallout that we had to deal with, there was something really powerful about being involved in that with other Canberrans who cared the same way that we did. So, yeah, it's always a tough decision kind of working out how to be engaged and how to use our energy well. And I guess you have to weigh up the consequences of various actions, but you don't always have a lot of control over what those consequences are and how people are going to respond. And we've been pretty lucky in a lot of ways, I think, that the things we've chosen to be involved with have been received really well. I think in the example of getting arrested, Dave locking on with Rick, who was a local farmer, there was something really powerful about that image where environmentalism does have a bit of a masculinity problem. And there you had a rugby player and a farmer. And I think trying to kind of find ways to challenge those ideas about who cares about this stuff is really important, and that's a good opportunity that we have.
And you've touched on there, like, obviously activism is really important to you both and clearly a part of your relationship as well. So how hard is it to pick where you're going to put your energies into and if you're going to use your public platform for things?
I guess we spend a lot of time talking about, like, what are the things that are most important to us. And so a big part of that has been kind of reorienting our energy into stuff to do with the environment. Over the last few years, we were pretty sort of accidentally involved in the marriage equality after Dave sort of casually made a comment to a New Zealand journalist about how we hadn't got legally married and then spent the next few years kind of talking about it, which, you know, was a fantastic thing and what a great outcome.
So for those in the audience who might not know that story, would you just mind sharing that with us quickly?
Go for it.
Dave doesn't want to get in trouble.
We wanted to get married in 2010, but yeah, it didn't feel like we could join or wanted to join this exclusive sort of thing that a lot of our friends, should they want to, couldn't have, you know, got married at the time. So it was just a private decision that we would have a little ceremony and a bit of a party but not sign anything until there was marriage equality, and copped a bit of grief from our family, which was interesting. Had some very interesting conversations with grandparents, Baptist grandparents. it was, I guess it wasn't really a thing until the 2011 World Cup. Kiwi journalist did a story on it. Yeah.
It became part of your story. Mm-hmm. I did want to touch on a little bit on some other comments that you made. I'm not sure when it was, but on field you pulled up, I think, the Waratahs and asked the umpire to address some homophobic slurs on the field. I think you also copped a bit of flack for that. But in talking about that, you kind of talked about the fact that your team had discussed that you weren't going to stand for that type of thing anymore. And so I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and the reaction to it as well, because I think it's the kind of thing where it'd be very easy to just let it slide and not say anything about it. But you know, things aren't going to change unless you do. And I was really struck by the fact that you said it was the team that had made that kind of decision.
Yeah, I think that's often the response is, you know, so it's just words, it doesn't matter. But I think words are really important. And you've obviously got the certain people in the media who talk about, you know, how everything's just getting politically correct and, you know, PC this and PC that. But I think words are really powerful in that they actually are creating our future. You know, how we frame things and how we talk about things frames how we think about them and how we potentially act. And so it was something that we talked about as a team, wanting to be a club where everyone felt that they could be themselves. I mean, if you look at the contact sports in Australia, in like the professional men's and the men's codes, I don't know of any openly sort of out players, and there'd be a few hundred of them, so statistically there have to be some.
Yeah.
And, you know, there've been a number of former players who've come out afterwards. And, yeah, we just talked about how the onus was not on them to be the hero and kind of come out, but to actually just feel like they could be whoever they are. And it just happened that we'd had that conversation in a team meeting probably a month or two before that happened.
Mm.
And so everyone was, I guess, really aware of it. And there were a few guys, who were bringing it up with the ref. And, you know, I think in the end, a lot of it's just about education, actually educating guys on the effect that their words can have.
It really struck me. It reminded me of the army chief who said, the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. But I thought it was really encouraging that it had been spoken about as a team, and it was a team decision. That seemed like a really positive way to approach it. Was it straightforward for them to come to that decision?
It was something that myself and a few other players had driven and just asked the coach if we could present something and actually put together a video, which was Gareth Thomas. He was the Captain Wales rugby team for years, legend of the game. And he actually came out at the end of his career. And it was him basically talking about how he had felt the need to be this other person. You know, he'd got married, he was the womanizer, the drinker, the party animal of the team, and in the end it was just too much for him.
Yeah.
And I think actually having that, seeing someone who, you know, everyone who plays rugby around my age or a bit younger knows who he is. He's one of the hard men of rugby. Like, he's incredibly tough on the field.
Yeah.
And to see him talk about just how hard it was hearing casual homophobic remarks in the change room certainly makes you think. And yeah, I think getting it out in the open actually allows guys to then, if someone says something, you say, "Oh, actually, mate, we're not talking like that anymore."
Yeah.
And we all know why.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a process, but well worth doing, I think.
And Emma, what's it like when those things, erupt and you find yourselves kind of in the spotlight a bit? How difficult is that to deal with?
It sort of depends. I mean, there's some things that you have a lot of time to prepare for and you can anticipate what the reactions might be and sort of think about how you might respond. In that instance, because it was something that happened on the field and kind of had become a bit of a thing before I think David even got into the change room, you're limited in terms of being able to plan for it. But in instances like that, I think it's a lot easier if you just try to consistently act with integrity, because then explaining yourself or having to answer questions is from a position of feeling comfortable with how you've behaved. It might be uncomfortable to be in the spotlight, but you don't have to carry any shame about what you've done. And we certainly don't always get that right. But I think if that's what you're kind of aiming for, is to not only, I guess, kind of behave with integrity, but be thoughtful about how you do that. And yeah, like in the instance with what happened in the game and how Dave thought things through with his teammates, trying to invite people into a conversation instead of telling them that, you know, your way is the right way. And I think that's something that we've kind of tried to do, is not buy into cycles of outrage or telling people, you know, this is the right way to do things or this is what you should think about an issue, but to try and help ask good questions.
So I think we'll go to audience questions shortly. And I will ask, as we go to questions, that putting on my Tony Jones hat, that people do ask questions and not monologue statements at our guests. That would be most appreciated. But before we move on to that part, I did just want to reflect again, Emma, as a, you know, a former youth worker and someone from the community development space, I guess looking back on all the things that you've been involved with and the campaigns. You know, neither of you are politicians, but you've both been, you know, very effective in your actions, essentially. Is there something that you'd like to, I guess, share with the audience tonight, or any lessons that you've learned over the past couple of years about what works and what doesn't? Or, yeah, you've kind of, I guess, talked about it being nourishing to be part of a community of people doing something. What are some of your, I guess, lessons from the past couple of years?
Oh, I don't know. I feel like as I get older, I get less sure about what I know. And particularly, I guess, that 6 months on the farm in Zimbabwe helped to unpack some of the early 20s confidence I had about how the world works. But I think that's one thing that we've both taken really seriously is having good mentors, having people in our lives who are older and wiser, and sometimes just wiser, not necessarily older than us, who we could ask questions of and when we were thinking about doing certain things, talk to about and get their feedback. And actually, moving to Canberra's been an amazing experience for both of us in that regard. It's a community that's rich with people who are wise, and I think that's been, I don't know what you would say, that's been one of the best things about moving here.
I'm going to briefly monologue. I'm a former junior rugby coach and first aider, and you have been a great role model to those young men as a rugby player who's not just a macho boofhead. I wanted to know who are some of your male role models for not displaying toxic masculinity.
Well, I think I was very fortunate to have a dad who, I don't know, he was born in the 60s, so he's got certain sort of traits, but I think has modelled to a large degree vulnerability. And he never always had it together, and I think that was a big thing growing up, is seeing someone who it was okay. Every now and then, things fell apart, things weren't going well. There's a lot of things out of our control, and that's okay. That's how life is. So I think he's probably been the biggest male role model. In terms of other ones. Probably my biggest hero is Desmond Tutu. I guess as a kid who grew up and seeing and then reading a lot about what he did during apartheid, and then since then, how he has, I don't know, he's kind of been the moral voice of South Africa for so long now, and I don't know, a great example of someone who's just so human, you know, great sense of humour, never gets ahead of himself too much. So I think that's probably enough, those two.
You both got a very strong interest in environmental aspects and ecology and ecological health. And David, you're studying the agroecology degree. I'm just thinking of your experiences in Zimbabwe and seeing the way that economic pressures came on those people and, you know, with their struggles and how they were trying to deal with it. And it's certainly not just in Zimbabwe that economic pressures come on and seem to be contrary to ecological health. Have you seen any kind of solutions areas where you think things are going to work and get better in that regard?
Well, I mean that's our big challenge, you know. As a society, we tend to measure things in terms of like dollar value, and you hear people talk about GDP and all these other things, but we're not actually putting a price on the loss of topsoil and, you know, the loss of trees and all these other things. They kind of just these costs that we think no one has to pay, but we're paying them, and we're going to be paying them in a big way going forward. So I know one of the world leaders in valuing ecosystem services was, or I think still is, here at the ANU, Costanza, I think it is. There's some amazing work in that field. I guess agriculture is such a big part of emissions and land use and degradation, and all, so it's going to have to be part of the solution. And so I think finding ways to farm in ways that are more ecologically sustainable, and I don't know. We visited the International Centre for Holistic Management in Zimbabwe while we were there, Alan Savory's sort of research station, and you drive through horrendously eroded sort of grassless communal areas to, you know, what struck me as was, you know, an oasis of perennial rivers and a huge amount of grass. So there's certainly people working on solutions. I think it's, I don't know how you do it in our society. I think a big part of that is people buying stuff, actually demanding that, pushing it sort of down the value chain like that, rather than going to farmers and saying, you need a farm like this. And he says, yeah, well, that's fine, but that's going to cost me an extra, you know, $500,000 a hectare or whatever it might be, and he's not going to get any more. But if consumers are actually willing to pay more, that may be one solution. But there's plenty of smarter minds than me thinking about it, so...
What about you, Emma?
Well, that was after the World Cup in 2015. We took just over a month in Southern and Eastern Africa visiting projects that are trying to combine conservation and agriculture. Obviously, in those they're very different environments to Australia in terms of the cost of labour and the specific kinds of pressures that they're facing from human-wildlife conflict. But there's a lot of good people thinking really hard about solutions to some of these problems that don't further marginalise people who are living on the edge of that kind of land. And I guess part of the concern is that this stuff is happening, but it's not happening fast enough, and there's not enough of it. And it does require a lot more of us to know about it and care about it and support it, because it certainly doesn't happen for free.
This question's for both of you, but I remember reading just before the Island series, David, that you'd sat down and had a chat to Izzy Folau one-on-one after his comments on homosexuality. And I was wondering for both of you just how you go about approaching those, I think, quite challenging topics for a lot of us progressives when you're talking to someone who shares very different views to you, and how you can have that respectfully.
I might go first, if that's okay. we had some pretty interesting conversations around that, but I actually grew up in a very conservative Christian home, and thought a lot about how angry homophobia makes me, but how well I know the kind of worldview that leads to that, and how often people who hold those kinds of views are actually quite scared about the world and how it's changing around them. And so while, you know, I obviously really disagree with statements that kind of marginalise that community, I also think it doesn't help us to just argue about things, and that trying to understand where someone you disagree with is coming from is usually the best place to start, because you probably have the most chance of at least not making them double down on their position. You might not change your mind, but you might not force them to become more extreme in their views.
Yeah, I think you know, we've got so much in common as humans when you kind of, I don't know, either, you know, get up close to someone. It's pretty hard to hate them when you actually get to know them as a person. Sure, we can have very different ideologies and some which I think are incredibly damaging and I'd really disagree with. But yeah, I've got family who were campaigning against marriage equality. As Emma said, I can see why they were doing it in their worldview, and I do think a lot of it is fear based. Based on uncertainty and not being okay with ambiguity, where you, it's a hard one. Like, obviously, there were a lot of opinions on me and Izzy and how we could play together and all that kind of stuff. But I guarantee you, there were guys who totally disagreed with me getting arrested, or even me thinking that the non-human world has value. Like, I'm sure there's guys in the team who think that. So we're never going to believe all the same things. So I think it's, just honouring that humanity and hopefully that actually leads to some conversations down the track. But it's a difficult thing.
While I'm only a casual observer on things Zimbabwe, but I was wondering if you since you are from the background that you are from the agricultural sector in Zimbabwe, the question is more about the general prospects for development in Zimbabwe and the agricultural sector, given the issues of land ownership, but also the government's call for farmers to return from the diaspora around the place. I have been a neighbour of an ex-Zimbabwean farmer, and I also note that in South Africa, questions of land ownership are seeming to come more forward in their debates now. And I suppose there's echoes of that here in Australia with the Indigenous land rights issue as well.
It's going to be a massive issue and something to sort out after this next election. So Zimbabweans go to the polls on the 30th of this month. It's messy. I don't think anyone really knows what sort of land tenure system they're going to move towards, whether they'll just nationalise all land and move to 99-year leases, as they've talked about, or actually go back to title deeds and freehold. There's certainly a lot of potential there. And, there's been a couple of decades of pain for people who lost their land, and for the average Zimbabwean who lives in a city and has gone through the hell of hyperinflation and mass unemployment and all the other things. So I'm not sure. I'm optimistic, but maybe that's
because you're a Zimbabwean.
Just the Zimbabwean in me. I honestly don't know, but I'd love to be involved in whatever that looks like. There's going to have to be some sort of new system. And, I think for all the pain and loss and everything over the last 20 years, Zimbabwe, in possibly one of the worst ways possible, has undergone the process of decolonization where they are dealing with the land issue. Where it goes to from here, I'm not too sure.
As you know, David, I'm a bit of a Brumbies fan. So I'm expecting you to be focused on the Rugby World Cup for the next 12 months. I'd just like to know what Emma's plans are for progressing things over that time.
For those who don't know, we're in the esteemed company of Brumby Man. It remains to be seen. I've just landed a job that I'm very excited about at the Australia Institute, so I will be there for the foreseeable future, and learning as much as I can and trying to soak up all the wisdom of people like Ebony. And then, yeah, I feel like I've got a bit of a buffer with the next 18 months here in Canberra at least, and just looking forward to being part of what's happening at the Institute.
I'll be focusing on rugby, Trev.
It's very reassuring. I like that you measure your life in World Cups. Yeah. A lot of people in Canberra measure around elections, so something a bit different.
I'm just wondering, earlier on when you were talking about your time in the farm in Zimbabwe, you said that it was going to get down to structural change. And I just wondered if you could expand on that. Do you mean only in Zimbabwe, or are you talking about the world, or are you talking about Australia and similar places? Like, what do you mean by structural change?
Well, I guess in Zimbabwe there's a lot of scope for structural change. We were there before the end of the Mugabe era, and I spent quite a bit of time thinking about how you make change, meaningful change in a country like Zimbabwe that's had 20 years of various forms of corruption increasing at all levels of government. I guess the circumstances in Australia are pretty different. We have a functioning rule of law for one, which is something that I haven't cherished quite so much as I did when I came back from Zimbabwe. And that gives you a certain amount of predictability in terms of outcomes. But I think that there's still a lot of scope for structural change here. Just today I was working on a blog post about a federal ICAC, and I think, you know, there are a lot of opportunities here for us to reduce our own corruption and improve things so that we don't see the possibility of things like a corporate tax cut, and instead look at things like increases to Newstart. It's a very different basket of issues in those two situations. And then I guess on top of that, you have a whole layer of structural change at the level of international politics. And I don't quite feel prepared to think about that just yet. Going from thinking about how we were going to get our tomato crop to the local town to sell to thinking about how you rid the immigration department of corruption because you have to pay a bribe every time you go through to thinking about a federal ICAC in Australia, I think that's enough for the time being.
Just picking up, I guess, on the idea of structural change and going back to the Brumby's decision to not accept homophobic slurs, that's kind of cultural change. How important is cultural change when you're trying to, move a big organisation from one place to another, do you think?
Crucial. I mean, that's how we change families, you know, schools, teams, society. And I guess that's, as I see it, one of our biggest problems at the moment with the debate and lack of action on climate change is that we've allowed a small minority in Australia to kind of derail the debate and actually shift what we're talking about from what are we going to do to, is it a problem? Like, can we afford, you know, as one of the richest countries in the richest time in history, can we actually afford to deal with this problem that could potentially mean that our grandchildren will not have a livable planet? To me, that's the big problem. And how do we actually talk about those things when the media is owned by a handful of people?
Yeah, certainly trying to get up some op-eds in News Limited can be difficult on some issues.
As young climate activists, do you have a sense of the kind of campaign that will mobilise young people in Australia, given how insecure that part of our population is with employment and living conditions? Do you have a sense of the elements of the climate campaign that will actually get young people mobilised in large numbers?
I think we differ in opinion on this. I don't know. I almost think we need a incredibly bold, like we clearly need a bold plan, but I think we need a politician who can actually articulate that. And I think I'm no expert in US politics, but watching their last election and Bernie Sanders and the young people kind of feeling that energy and actually saying, hey, here's an old guy who's actually standing for something. This is something I can be part of. I just find it astounding that, you know, in 8 years the US could put someone on the moon, but we don't have a politician who's willing to actually come up with a big vision that says, okay, we're actually going to deal with this, and we're going to deal with it in 10 years, not we'll lock in these emissions in 2025 and then potentially decrease them by 2% a year. And like, no one wants to hear that. Yeah, but it's I don't know. Like, you know, you go to rallies and events and you know, sadly there aren't a huge number of young people, and I don't know what, I'm sure there's lots of different reasons for that. Yeah. I believe part of it is that as young Australians, you kind of look at politics and go, well, you know, Labor or Liberal, things aren't going to change that much for me, so what's the point? I guess growing up in Zimbabwe and kind of seeing what politics can look like, I'm one, incredibly grateful for to have the opportunity here, but also think it can be a lot better, and I think we can all be part of building a better system and a better society, and I don't know. It might sound idealistic or naive, but yeah, why not? Like, it's just 23 million people. We can certainly change things. Yeah.
What about you, Emma?
I feel like that's...
Emma's more measured.
but I also don't have a good answer to that question. I mean, if I did, I'd be trying to make it happen. I mean, I think there are a lot of young people who are engaged, and that their mode of engagement means that they're not necessarily always that visible. Things happen in online spaces rather than... you know, at rallies.
And we're playing Fortnite.
but I think it part of it comes back to how disconnected we are from the natural world. I mean, it's a bit easier in Canberra to feel connected to it. It's not called the bush capital for nothing, but the bulk of my friends and peers... spend very little time in nature, and it's hard to care about something that you don't love or you don't know that you love.
I mean, even calling it like the environment, it's our home. Like, we're part of the environment. Isn't out there, like, we are part of the environment. So I don't know, just we are so disconnected, and I don't think it's good for us. I don't know what the solutions are, but certainly in the long term, it's going to catch up with us, and I think it already is in many ways.
Going back to Desmond Tutu, obviously one of your idols, and the role of civil disobedience there. And do you think having part of that heritage growing up and learning about that, and having idols like that, was part of you being willing to engage in that type of thing, seeing how successful those types of campaigns have been. Certainly Australia's had some experience of that, but probably not at such a visible level globally. Do you think that made a big impact on you?
Yeah, I think it definitely did. I guess reading a lot about that and seeing the personal cost it had for those people, and then I guess looking at how much privilege I have as a white heterosexual male in Australia, and then, you know, playing rugby. I certainly feel like I want to try and use that in any way I can. And I think someone else who I've, in sport, Muhammad Ali, like, really stands out for me as someone who put it all on the line for his beliefs, you know, agree with them or not. And yet paid a massive personal cost in not being able to box for a number of years. And the fallout from that was massive. So I guess there's plenty of examples out there if we're willing to look for them.
We were on the Super Digger for 2 hours longer than you, but anyway, beside that, just about what you were talking about, Em. Hi. Oh, it was awesome. But this is the thing. This is the thing. The cops were really kind to us. We had really good... We had nothing as what's happening now in Queensland with the Adani lock-ons. There's nothing that since the new laws have been introduced to New South Wales. Mm-hmm. And I liked what you were saying, David, about the mass disobedience and everything online. So if we stay at home disobedience, you know, like just don't go anywhere and stay online, something like that. How do you organise that sort of thing? But I like the meld of both of your sort of ideas, where because of the laws being so prohibitive in actual direct action these days in Tasmania, New South Wales, Queensland, probably everywhere. Victoria remains at least half decent. WA is pretty crap. Don't know about South Australia, Northern Territory. But it's just... Yeah, this is Northern Territory and South Australia have got distance issues, and there's so much happening in every state of Australia. I like that online and mass disobedience combined, maybe. What do you...
I don't know. I mean, I guess I think one thing to keep in front of mind all the time is that as our governments are making these changes to silence us, to bear in mind that they serve us and that they are elected at our pleasure. And we cede a lot of power. And I think that in Australia there's an inclination to not want to talk about politics. When you actually look at the statistics, very few people actually know who cabinet ministers are. And I think that we'd all be well served by talking more to the people in our lives about politics, about the way that political decisions actually affect our lives in a day-to-day sense, and reconnect those dots. I mean, that's one thing that I really took away from our time in Zimbabwe, is that ordinary Zimbabweans know exactly what's going on politically because their lives depend on it a lot of the time. And I think a lot of our lives do too, but we're so disconnected from the reality of that, which I don't think is a coincidence. That's one thing I've been trying really hard to do since we've been back, is talking to people in my life who I know aren't necessarily that interested in politics about the way that different decisions that are being made or not made might affect their lives. And that's something that we can all do. And I think that's not just a pat thing. I think that actually makes a really significant difference.
Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think it's... You're right. Like, all these law changes are not good. But I think we are going to start to see more and more people make the connection between saying, yeah, you know, I love my children or my grandchildren. I'd do anything for them. I'd die for them. At what point do you then go, well, actually, if I love them that much, I want them to have a planet that's livable. And one thing I can do is civil disobedience or non-violent direct action. Or you know, I think as more and more people start to draw that connection, we're going to see more people willing to cop the consequences. And you know, I think when there's thousands of people doing that, it's going to be pretty hard to lock them all up.
I asked before if it was scary, but it sounds like it was a lot of fun as well.
I got pretty sunburnt, but it was... It's such a good group of people.